Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 350, recorded for April 7th, 2026. It looks like you're trying to send an email from 250,000 miles away. Would you like help with that? Good evening, Matt and Jonathan. How are you guys doing?
Good, thanks, Justin.
I'm good.
Well, thank you for joining me on my birthday. I appreciate it.
Happy birthday.
I think
we ever recorded on my birthday before. It's a first for the podcast.
Yeah.
But my wife isn't here. My kids are here. Drive me crazy. So yeah, it's a great birthday. But we get to record a podcast, so that's all that really matters. Well, we have some follow-up news here. First up, I'm sad to say that even if you leave this planet, you will still deal with Outlook and Microsoft, as apparently the Artemis II astronauts dealt with Outlook hiccup in deep space. The Artemis II astronauts aboard NASA's Orion spacecraft encountered a common Outlook configuration issue on their first day in space, requiring remote IT support from Mission Control to resolve it by reloading the commander's files. NASA used commercial off-the-shelf software like Microsoft Outlook for crew scheduling and personal communications, while keeping primary flight systems on separate radiation-hardened hardware, illustrating a practical separation of concerns in mission-critical environments. The Outlook issues stem from the app having configuration problems when no direct network connection is available, which the flight detector noted is not uncommon, raising questions about offline readiness for software deployed in connectivity-constrained environments. This incident is a useful reminder for cloud and enterprise software users that applications heavily dependent on network connectivity can behave unpredictably in low or no connectivity scenarios, and offline mode reliability remains an important consideration for software selection. I did watch the Project Hail Mary, if you haven't seen that, but they did not have any Microsoft Outlook software in that. So I, you know, clearly in the future, when the world is going to be ending from a weird, you know, astrophage, you know, we'll be fine because they won't have Outlook anymore. So I'm hoping there's still a chance for me.
I haven't seen the movie yet.
It's so good.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. The book was good.
The book was great. I read the book when it came out. I'm a big Andy Weir fan in general, but the movie was really good. It's close enough to the book that I have no quibbles. So
that's good. I heard some comments that although the stories are the same, the takeaways from the experience of the book is different than the takeaway from the movie.
Well, I mean, there's a big twist that you find out in the, you know, basically the beginning of the third act about how he ends up in space. That's different in the movie that I think in the movie actually plays differently than it does in the book. And so you have a different emotion leaving that as you do from the book versus the movie. But both of them are excellent. So again, I highly recommend seeing it.
Wonderful.
It's probably only in the theater for a few more weeks, so do it quick.
I thought it just came out.
I mean, like movies are only in the theater for like 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and they're out again.
I don't think I've seen a movie in the theater since before COVID. So I guess my sense of how long things are in theaters is not that anymore.
Is it COVID or having kids? For me, it's kids.
It's both.
It's the perception of time. It's crazy.
Yeah, I don't go as often as I used to, but I try to go to like big movies that I'm excited about. But yeah, this one was definitely one I know Mario kicked it out of the Dolby Theater, which is where I saw it. I think it might be still in the IMAX Theater, our local place, Jonathan. But
I'll check that out.
Yeah, worth checking out. Iran has declared AWS, Google, and Microsoft data centers as military targets. This happened in April with their declaration naming the Joint Warfighting Cloud Capability JWC contract specifically as the reason why AWS, Google, Microsoft, and Oracle data centers hosting Pentagon AI and intelligence workloads have lost civilian status under the Geneva Convention Principles of Distinction. This means that these data centers now have a new paradigm in the world, especially with the war going on in the Middle East, and they're considered safe targets for war type attacks. So now in the case of FedRAMP and JWCC, those are typically in the FedRAMP data centers in the US. So it's a little bit of an interesting distinction, but I'm not, you know, there's no guarantee that they're not putting FedRAMP type workloads into regions closer to the war zone. There's no conversation about that. So, I mean, I can see Iran's point in this, and this will definitely make insurance and operating in clouds more expensive for companies who are very politically sensitive, and geopolitical tensions are only rising as we almost had World War III today, but he blinked at the last minute.
Yeah, two more weeks.
I mean, we won't get into this too much, but 90 seconds after that came out, they attacked Israel. So, I mean, the ceasefire is going great. Yeah.
I'm waiting for I have a friend that does data center build outs for the cloud vendors, and I'm waiting for her to talk to her again and be like, yeah, so our newest data centers, we have drone, you know, anti-drone things on the roof and things like that. just
I mean, that's definitely a consideration that they're going to have to make now is,
yeah,
you know, how do you tackle those type of issues, and do you have to put defensive things on them? I mean, people laugh about Switch data center in Las Vegas because they have armed guards, but, you know, they allegedly have sensitive, you know, government contracts as well. And so I don't think you see that today with Amazon data centers. I mean, I don't drive by them very often, so maybe they'd have that today, but if they don't today, they will in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember visiting an AT&T data center, and it was a very high security. It's, you know, multiple rings of fences with barbed wire and security at each thing. Each thing you check in, all your electronic equipment as you walk in the door. It's worse than airport screening. It's very, very interesting experience there. I'm not quite sure how I feel about the military classification of something which is a shared utility, though. I mean, I get the intent, obviously, but then, you know, nuclear power plant is also shared infrastructure, and roads are shared infrastructure because the military sometimes drives on them. So I guess where does the line get drawn?
I was going to say, like, the highways in the U.S. were originally designed for military movement.
And landing planes on interstates, yeah.
Right. So at that point, the lines get blurry really fast. And it's not like, you know, AWS is going to say, this data center over here is, that's where we keep our high security stuff, and that's the customer one. I feel like they're not going to go that far out. Also, you know, telling the world where their data centers are is not normally in their list of things to do.
I mean, the reality is the status quo of military warfare and diplomacy has completely changed now after the last, you know, few weeks here. So, it's all going to change. And this is a new paradigm in that change that we'll have to now deal with as practitioners of cloud and compute resources and things, and it'll only get things more difficult in the future. You know, sovereignty is a big issue right now too, for the same reason. You know, if things go wrong between the United States and Europe, you know, how do you make sure that all these hyperscalers are all U.S. entities can't access European data, and what's the protections on those sort of things? So lots of these questions are being asked globally right now due to geopolitical challenges in the world.
Yeah, there's some two things really interesting though, because in KSA, for example, if the government is a customer of that region,
mm-hmm.
and that data center gets attacked, then you are also attacking the Saudi Arabia's own infrastructure, not just the U.S. military infrastructure. So it's, yeah.
Well, I mean, even attacking something like Aramco, which is partially owned by the crown, potentially puts you into like attack on the state. So mm-hmm. there's all kinds of fun wrinkles as you get into, you know, peel this onion, if you will. All right, let's move on to tokens, because that's much more exciting.
Woo!
OpenAI is introducing pay-as-you-go pricing for Codex-only seats within ChatGPT business and enterprise workspaces, billing on token consumption with no rate limits instead of a fixed per-seat fee, giving teams more cost visibility across their workflow. ChatGPT business annual pricing drops from $25 to $20 per seat for teams that want standard ChatGPT access with Codex use limits included, while the new Codex-only seat option serves teams that want dedicated coding agent access without the broader ChatGPT bundle. OpenAI is offering eligible business workspaces $100 credits per new Codex-only team member added, capped at $500 per team for a limited time, which lowers the barrier for your pilot. Codex now supports plugins and automations through its macOS and Windows app, allowing teams to connect the coding agent to existing internal systems and tooling rather than treating it as a standalone tool. OpenAI has reported that over 2 million weekly active Codex builders and a 6x growth in Codex users within business and enterprise accounts since January, with named customers including Notion, Ramp, and Braintest using standardized engineering workflows. That's interesting on this one for me, because with Claude Code, you know, I like having the fact that I get access to Claude Chat and to Cowork and to Claude Code, although there is an API-only option with Claude Code that I can use, which we'll talk about here in a moment. But I, you know, it's interesting to give you the flexibility, but I wonder if bundling will be the way these things get sold typically, or it'll really be, you know, pay for what you use.
I think if you want the best performance, you're going to have to pay for what you use. I think anyone who's paying a bundle is always going to be a second class user, and they will always take sort of second place in the queue to somebody who's paying list price. I mean, it's just kind of pitched as a good thing for businesses, but pay-as-you-go pricing is expensive. So, you mm-hmm. know, a minor discount on the per seat pricing plus pay-as-you-go pricing is really not cheaper. You may have cost visibility per user, but it's always going to be super expensive.
All you made me think about was, you know, queues and high priority and low priority queues and everything along those lines. And my brain went into, are these vendors going to start to prioritize customers? You know, they already do some at, you know, free tier versus non-free tier.
I think they're doing that a lot today.
But do you think they're doing it at the higher tiers also versus, you know, your standard credit versus your add-on credits and things along those lines? Because I know they're doing it with free and non-free, but are they going to start to prioritize within the other tiers and say the 20X plan gets priority if there's capacity issues over the 5X?
I mean, I think they always have done that. I think that's true. You know, and I think you see it when, you know, OpenClaw kind of blew up and there was a bunch of people buying Mac minis and earning out there. You know, you saw a bunch of, you know, constraints are happening inside of Max plans and in other pro plans. So I think you see that as they roll out new models as well, but, you know, the higher paid plans get access to the newer models sooner. They get access to more tokens on those models because they're willing to spend more money on those particular models in those cases. So that's just the reality of these things. I think you will end up in a situation where you realize that a lot of these bundled packages are actually very subsidized by these vendors and you're getting subsidized access. And if you really want to be competitive, you have to pay by the API call. So,
I mean, they've proven that. I think there was something I read where it's like 3 or 4X number of tokens if you versus doing full add-on. But I guess my question is, if you're on the, let's say the $200 for cloud, and is that going to be lower priority than someone who's already hit their $200 quota and now is moving on to the add-on amounts? Like, that's, I guess, the nuance I'm thinking about.
Inside of that, yeah, I don't think that's, that distinction would not be there today, but that'll be interesting too. If your free included ones get lower priority than the ones you're paying per API call. I mean, I don't notice the difference in speed between when I jump between the two, but also it's very difficult to know when you're leaving the pro plan and you're going into your APIs versus not. They're not very clear on some of that when it happens. So it's hard to say.
I keep mine off until I hit the limit and then I manually turn it on each time for that reason.
Yeah, I do the same.
I want to know when I hit that buffer limit because like today I was working on something and it was like 15 minutes until it reloads. And I was like, I don't need to pay. I can wait 15 minutes. I'm patient enough for that sometimes.
Yeah, it sounds like a good coffee break time. That's
yeah. You know, I don't need to spend money for the sake of it because I can't wait 15 minutes though, you know.
But yeah, you know, the other thing, I'm using a lot of sub agents these days and a lot of, you know, like spinning off sub agents and work trees and things like that. And so, you know, the ability to burn through a token usage cap for me is much faster now than it used to be.
Apparently, I'm the only sucker who pays for the $200 plan.
Oh, no, I pay for the $200 plan too. I'm saying I'm paying for the $200 plan plus I'm paying for usage after that.
I thought you were using Bedrock for a lot of things.
I was, but I've pivoted because I wanted the Chrome integration and some of the other features that are now only coming out in the more advanced. So I switched back to the Pro plan. But yeah,
got it.
But I honestly, when I get to the API usage limit, I should just use the API on Bedrock. If it didn't have the limitations like not being able to do auto mode, a couple other things, I probably would. But
I'm sure if they have decent cache support in Bedrock.
They don't. That's one thing I did notice when I switched back was that my token usage dramatically dropped from, you know, new tokens versus cache hit tokens. So yeah, the token caching is not as good for sure.
Yeah, that will definitely cost a lot more money in the end.
Yeah. Anthropic says that Cloud Code subscribers will need to pay extra for OpenClaw usage now. Starting April 4th, which is a little bit earlier this week, Anthropic is requiring Cloud Code subscribers to pay separately on a pay-as-you-go basis for usage through third-party tools like OpenClaw, rather than drawing from their existing subscription limits. This affects all third-party harnesses with more platforms to follow. Anthropic's head of Cloud Code cited infrastructure constraints and unsustainable usage patterns from third-party tools as the reason for the change, and noted the company is offering full refunds to subscribers who are unaware of the policy shift. The timing is notable given that OpenClaw's creator, Peter Steinberger, recently joined OpenAI, and OpenClaw continues as an open source project within OpenAI backing. Steinberger publicly stated he attempted to negotiate with Anthropic and only managed to delay the pricing change by 1 week. For developers building or using AI coding assistants through third-party integrations, this signals a broader industry pattern where AI providers may separate subscription pricing from API-level or harness-level consumption, adding cost complexity for teams relying on open source tooling around proprietary models.
I'm really on the fence about this. I understand why they're doing it, because there's a big difference between somebody having a conversation or somebody doing coding where you are mostly using cache hits for the majority of the work versus OpenClaw where the context changes constantly and you're making a call every 60 seconds. It's a completely different type of workload. At the same time, I'm paying $200 a month, and I'd really like to be able to split that between, you know, the Claude apps, Claude Desktop, Claude Code, and perhaps some API usage as well, so I can run some other things. Like, as a developer of services, it would be nice to be able to consume some of that to test the services I'm building, rather than paying separately.
It's pretty opaque to see the usage even in Claude and like an Anthropic, like what you're using and different models and like how much of your usage is Claude Code versus how much is Cowork versus how much is Chat. It's not easy. And I do wish there was more granularity in some of that pricing capability to help you make that decision, but they had to get that before they can give you what you want, Jonathan. So.
Yeah.
So we need the vendors. We need all these AI vendors to follow up and go on the focus route.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that a lot of tooling is going to come out at FinOpsX this year in June around AI token tracking. I think it's going to be a big, big area of announcements in particular. So we'll see. Anthropic is expanding their partnership with Google and Broadcom for multiple gigawatts of next-generation compute. This is a new TPU capacity agreement with Google and Broadcom, with infrastructure expected to come online starting in 2027. Not a moment too soon. This builds on existing October 2025 TPU expansion and deepens Anthropic's reliance on Google Cloud alongside AWS and NVIDIA hardware. Anthropic's run rate revenue has grown from roughly $9 billion at the end of 2025 to over $30 billion, with enterprise customers spending over $1 million annually, doubling from 500 to over 1,000 in under 2 months. The compute expansion is a direct response to this accelerating demand. Anthropic continues a multi-cloud hardware strategy, running Claude on AWS Trainium, Google TPUs, and NVIDIA GPUs to match workloads to appropriate chips. Amazon remains the primary cloud and training partner while ongoing work on Project Rainier. Claude is currently the only frontier AI model available across all three major cloud platforms, Bedrock, Vertex, and Azure Foundry. And this broad availability has practical implications for enterprises already committed to any of the three major cloud providers.
Yeah, I read recently that something like $500 million a week in sales are doing right now.
Yeah, that's crazy. We were just doing a contract recently, and we're trying to get the enterprise plan. And like, you know, we'd email the sales rep, and then a week and a half later, she'd respond. And you'd respond back to her like within 5 minutes. And then another week and a half later, she'd respond to you again. And you know, she's super apologetic. She's like, we're just so slammed right now with all these deals coming through. And so, yeah, if you weren't spending millions of dollars, I think you were getting lower priority in the queue, as Matthew pointed out earlier.
I mean, they're hot, and clearly their sales are showing it. So,
yeah. And our final Anthropic story this week, big Anthropic week. So last week, a rumor dropped about Anthropic having created a new model called Mythos, which they said was, you know, which the rumors were saying was potentially the scariest model created yet. And so, of course, because it leaked, they had to now announce it officially. And so they're officially announcing Project Glasswing, a coalition using including AWS, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Cisco, NVIDIA, and others, built around a new unreleased model called Claude Mythos Preview that is focused specifically on finding and fixing software vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure. Mythos Preview has already identified thousands of high-severity vulnerabilities autonomously, including a 27-year-old flaw in OpenBSD, a 16-year-old bug in FFmpeg that survived 5 million automated test runs, and a Linux kernel privilege escalation chain, all of which have since been patched. The model will not be generally available, but partners can access it via Claude API, Amazon Bedrock, Google Cloud Vertex AI, and Microsoft Foundry at $25 per million input tokens and $125 per million output tokens after an initial period covered by 100 million in Anthropic usage credits. Anthropic is donating 4 million to open source security organizations, including Alpha Omega, OpenSSF through the Linux Foundation, and the Apache Software Foundation to help maintainers respond to the vulnerabilities the model surfaces. The initiative signals a shift in how AI safety and capability trade-offs are being handled in practice, with Anthropic planning to test new cybersecurity safeguards on an upcoming Claude Opus model before considering any broader deployment of Mythos class capabilities.
What a great position to be in, though, to be in the position to sell the model that can find every vulnerability and cause havoc in the world, and also be the company that has the smart AI that can solve the problems.
Exactly. It's a double-edged sword. Like, we detect it and we fix it. There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. I mean, we definitely expect to see newer and better models still coming out. And so the fact that they think this model is this scary is impressive. I'm a little bit skeptical as well, as one of the things that Anthropic has a tendency to do is to be a little bit overly ambitious about what they think their things can do. You know, like the fact that, you know, SaaSageddon is all because of them, and that, you know, all companies are going to destroy their SaaS contracts because they're going to just be able to build it with Opus. Like, I mean, some of that stuff is hyperbole in the strongest sense. And so you know, is it probably really great at finding stuff? Is it really good at chaining things together to find these attacks? Yes. Is it as scary as they make it out to be? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Time will tell. I'm not going to be spending money on Mythos tokens to find out. But I am curious to see what people are coming out with now that it's out in the wild. It just dropped this morning. So we'll keep an eye on this one for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bow out of that one too. That's a little pricey.
Yeah. It's getting a bit really expensive, but if you're running something that, you know, either runs on a lot of systems or is,
I mean, if I'm an operating system vendor, or I'm a SaaS vendor, you bet your butt I'm using this because this thing can save you a ton of pain in security vulnerabilities. And if you're, you know, if you're not using it, nation state hacking groups are going to definitely be using it. So like there is a risk to not using it, but I just don't know that my hobby projects require it.
Yeah, no, my hobby projects I could care less about. Please hack them, have fun.
I don't think Bolt will require this level of security scanning, but and if someone hacks Bolt, they got my API key to Anthropic. Oops.
There are a lot of cloud cost management tools out there, but only Archera provides insured commitments. It sounds fancy, but it's really simple. Archera gives you the cost savings of a 1 or 3 year AWS savings plan with a commitment as short as 30 days. If you do not use all the cloud resources you've committed to, Archera will literally cover the differences. Other cost management tools may say they offer insured commitments, but remember to ask, will you actually give me my rebate? Archera will. Check out thecloudpod.net/Archera to schedule a demo today.
AWS news this week. First up, I noticed this in the console first because I'm working on some heavy-duty ECS development. Managed daemons are now available to you, which let platform engineers deploy and update monitoring, logging, and tracing agents independently from application teams, eliminating the need to coordinate task definition changes or service redeployments across hundreds of services. Daemons are guaranteed to start before application tasks and drain last, ensuring operational tooling like CloudWatch Agent is always available throughout the application lifecycle, including during rolling updates. A new daemon bridge network mode keeps daemon containers isolated from application networking while still allowing communication, and daemons support privileged container access and host file system mounts for deep system-level visibility. Each instance runs exactly one daemon copy shared across all application tasks on that instance, which optimizes resource utilization and allows CPU and memory parameters to be managed centrally without rebuilding AMIs or modifying application task definitions. The feature is available now in all AWS regions at no additional charge beyond standard compute costs, as long as ECS exists there.
Nice. Like what a useful feature.
Yeah, I popped up and I said, like, what is a daemon? And I was like, looking at it, I was like, oh, this is where you run CrowdStrike or you run your, you know, your penetration testing or other things that, you know, are always kind of a, you know, they're typically privileged. So you know, they're always a little bit scary, and not having it run with the application container is really nice. So I think this is a great enhancement in general.
Yeah, as I said, then the network bridge thing reminds me of sort of the olden days, as it were, when we used to have a backup or management network as in addition to the customer facing network for that kind of monitoring traffic. So it's like we weren't totally wrong back then.
We weren't crazy, just premature. Yeah. Amazon SES is adding support for optional start TLS configurations, allowing legacy systems that lack full start TLS support to still connect to Mail Manager without requiring a full infrastructure overhaul. Mutual TLS adds certificate-based authentication at the ingress endpoint level, giving organizations a stronger identity verification layer for inbound email connections beyond standard encryption. Two new rules actions expand email processing flexibility. Invoke Lambda lets you trigger custom code directly from rule sets for advanced routing or transformation logic. But the bounce action sends RFC-compliant SMTP rejection responses back to sending servers. These features are now available across most SES mail manager regions, with a notable exception of the Middle East, UAE, and Middle East Bahrain regions. So don't expect it there. Microsoft pricing for SES mail manager follows existing SES user-based pricing. I mean, it's only taken them 15 years to give us start TLS optionality. Thanks, I guess.
So you could either have it or you couldn't before, but there was no,
correct.
You
can no
have
optional.
It sometimes. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Which, you know, is a big issue. They've actually added a lot of features to mail manager recently. You know, the fact that it now can handle bounce protection and handles all of that stuff that you set to build your own for. You know, it's nice that stuff's now there. The deliverability management stuff is pretty nice. So there's definitely been a big investment in SES capabilities over the last couple of years, which I appreciate.
I think it goes back to our conversation. How much is Curio kind of
helping.
Taking out that backlog of items and letting, you know, the interns or, you know, let a dev just go at all these backlog PFRs that are out there.
I mean, that could definitely be part of it, but it also causes more outages, apparently. So, you know.
Don't worry about that. Minor details.
Details.
I think with the Lambda support, they've kind of turned it into a, you know, if this, then that for email for AWS. It's very powerful.
I'd love for them to pull it into the workflow engine, which I forget the name of at this moment.
Step functions.
Step functions. Thank you. I'd love for them to be able to put into step functions because then you can do some really cool, simple rule sets versus just Lambda invocation, which is fine too. But
didn't I see that they were shutting down Workmail? Or is that?
Workmail is no longer taking new customers, so it's in maintenance at this point.
Okay.
I think they gave up on the dream of being able to compete with Outlook.
Especially after AWS or Amazon was supposed to move to O365.
Yeah, exactly. Amazon Bedrock Guardrails now support cross-account safeguards and general availability, letting organizations enforce a single guardrail policy across all AWS accounts and organizational units for a central management account, covering every Bedrock model invocation automatically. There are two enforcement levels, organizational level enforcement, which applies the guardrails via AWS organization policies to all member accounts and OUs, while account level enforcement applies guardrails to all Bedrock inference calls within a single account, giving teams flexibility to layer the controls. A notable configuration option lets admins choose between comprehensive mode, which enforces guardrails on all content regardless of caller tag, and selective mode, which only applies guardrails to content that callers explicitly tag, useful for mixed workloads with pre-validated and user-generated content. One practical gotcha worth flagging, though, specifying an incorrect guardrail ARN in the policy does not fail silently. It blocks all Bedrock model inference for affected accounts, so ARN accuracy is critical before attaching policies to production OUs. This is like group policies on Windows. If you are not careful, you can lock yourself out of your domain. So be careful in how you apply these, but good to see centralized control.
I feel like you've done that in the past.
Oh, yeah. I've messed up a group policy many a times and had to recover in a horrible ways. So, yes.
I'm just thinking the time I blocked all access to an S3 bucket, and the only way to fix it was go into the root account in order to fix the bucket policy. It's the same type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the group policy has weird inheritance rules. And so the one I enabled was a disable Windows interactive login. But it was at an OU level that ended up accidentally cascading down to the user OU, which, you know, if you can't log in interactively to Windows boxes, you can't do much of anything. And the only reason why I was saved is because I hadn't logged out of the server. I was able to reuse my session that hadn't been updated yet. That was a fun outage in RCA that I had to write, be accountable for. AWS Cost Explorer now supports natural language queries powered by Amazon Q Developer, letting users ask plain English questions like, show me my top spending services this month, and receives both written insights and automatically updated charts, filters, and groupings simultaneously. The feature supports conversational follow-up questions with maintained context, meaning users can move from a quick cost check to a detailed investigation without switching tools or manually reconfiguring visualizations. When Amazon Q pulls from additional datasets beyond raw costs and usage data, such as pricing catalogs or anomaly detection, those results appear in separate artifacts panel rather than the main Cost Explorer view. I did play with this because I was curious, and I've done a lot of really cool things with AI for cost management recently. It's not very good. like most Amazon Q things, it's not great. So it's April, but when I was playing with this, it was closer to March, and so I asked it, why is March, 10% more expensive than February? And it didn't pick up the fact that there's more days in March. four more days in March. It's kind of a big deal in billing in particular. But because it's in the console, it doesn't have some of the application insights, which is where I think the actual real value of AI and FinOps comes into play. Because if I have access to the source code and I have access to the Amazon console command CLI tools, I can basically ask Claude, like, hey, why was my Amazon other bill so high this month? And it can look at the source code, look at what I'm doing in the application, things like, there was things that I was doing like, oh, you're not caching SSM parameters properly in your code. So you're making a SSM parameter call on every call, which is costing you a lot of money once you pass the free tier. Like, just basic things like that, you have to have enough application insights to have that connection to know that that's why you're burning so much money on parameters. And that combination of having the source code of the applications running plus the cost data together is really powerful. Where Amazon Q, because it's contained to Amazon, doesn't have that insight, unless it's in like serverless functions or something where it has the source code. But that's very rare in most use cases that you have just a serverless function at play.
Yeah, you'd think they could actually look at the fact that you're pulling the same key all the time and maybe point it out.
I mean, you could, again, like if you had all your, you should have CloudTrail turned on. So yes, it should be in CloudTrail. You're calling the same thing from this principle, but then that would require the Amazon Q to basically go pull CloudTrail data at scale, which isn't easy to do in context. So like, how much control do you want to have to do those things? But yes, you're right. It could, if you had all the other data already plumbed and you're already paying for it, then yes, it could in theory do that, but it's not that smart. That's my reality.
Yeah. Do you ever call Movie Phone years ago? When
I do, yeah.
Remember Movie Phone? I remember that. All these voice interactions with AIs in front of pretty much every service the cloud offers now, which reminds me of Movie Phone. I'm wondering if we'll end up with 800 numbers to call to get your cloud bill.
Oh, God.
This Friday, your bill will be ridiculously large.
You use Mythos, you idiot.
Turn on pissed off CFO mode.
Yeah. Well, if you guys were excited about the fact that LM Studio exists on Google, and you can go and put any article you want to in there and get generated a two-person podcast that you can ask live questions to as a studio call-in thing. And you said to yourself, man, I really wish Amazon had that capability. Let me tell you, they've given you one piece of the puzzle with Amazon Nova 2 Sonic, speech model available through the Bedrock that handles a real-time conversational AI with support for 7 languages and a 1 million token context window, make it practical for voice-first applications like customer support interactive learning. And the AWS blog post demonstrates a proof of concept podcast generator that uses 2 Novasonic instances to simulate a host and expert dialogue, streaming audio in real time using a Flask and async IO architecture with RX Pi for reactive event processing. So if you want a really bad way to do this, you can use this blog post and spend a lot more money than versus just go use LM Studio. But it's nice to have a model architecture, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Still not out of a podcasting job. Yeah, got it.
Not yet.
Not soon. Yet. It's getting close though.
Jonathan's working on it.
Yeah. What do we talk about every week, though, if we had AI do the news for us? That's the question.
I don't know what it would talk about. It's a question.
I feel like our chat would be a lot less of, who's available to actually do the podcast this week and more of real topics.
I mean, the real thing is that the articles that we talk about are not really the part of the show. It's really the insight that the four of us bring to the conversation about like how you might actually use this or what are some use cases. And that's what typically listeners tell me all the time is like, the news is great, but it's really the conversations you guys have about the tech that they like. So I don't think the podcast could do that. The AI could do that yet.
But I thought maybe, it was our level of cynicism.
I mean, that's probably the enjoy as well. I mean, it's a good time to say, hey, if you'd like to review the podcast, we haven't asked for reviews in a bit. But yeah, we'd love to get iTunes reviews or Google podcast reviews if you're listening and hearing us out there. So finally, this article was announced this morning for Amazon S3 Files. And we're linking to, of course, the Amazon blog post as we typically do. And I will tell you that I read that blog post and I had no idea what they were announcing. Not a clue. But thank God for Corey Quinn, as he posted a whole write-up on Last Week in AWS, which we will also link to. It basically tells you what this actually is. And so once I read his article, I was like, oh, okay, I understand. So basically what they've done is instead of trying to do dumb things like Fuse to basically make your application talk object storage, they basically added a layer on top of your S3 bucket that allows you to take hot files that the operating system will actually need to use and access them as EFS. So basically it's an EFS proxy on top of S3. Which allows you to basically, depending on the size of the object you want, basically read it from the S3 bucket, put it into the hot tier, then allow the application to use the hot tier appropriately, and then write it back to there. There's lots of use cases for this, particularly inside of AI ML use cases, which is why they built it, of course. But there's also some other interesting legacy use cases, too. I was thinking about a CMS application I was using that didn't have native S3 support, but I wanted to be able to use buckets to do CloudFront backing of images. So, using this, you could actually create a hybrid file system basically between an EFS and a S3 system that basically the image manipulations happens by the CMS, gets stored on the disk, and then replicated out to S3. where CloudFront could then pick it up like you expect in a web application. So there are some interesting use cases I think will come out of this. It's a bit pricey if you're not careful, especially doing file scans. So you wouldn't want to do a lot of file operations across your system via the EFS mount to the S3, because every time you pick those files up, even if it's 1 kilobyte, you're paying for 32 kilobytes, I believe is what I saw the math is. Corey has some good examples of this where you want to be careful, but definitely great article.
Yeah, in other possibly related news, the NetApp stock price is down from $104 to $96 in the past 24 hours, because that's basically what NetApp tiered storage does.
Correct. Yes.
So. But yeah, finally no S3FS, finally no crappy user mode interface to S3, and sensible handling of incremental updates and things. It's great. Like, why did it take him so long?
Exactly. I think it's a good middle ground, though, because I think this is the people trying to do Fuse are always trying to recreate POSIX, and it's like, well, that's not really what you need. You what is your use case? And the use case that you have for AI or ML or training workloads, it's like, well, I have a massive amount of data that's in an S3 bucket that I need to be able to access on a hot tier across multiple machines and be able to potentially orchestrate across them. Like, it makes sense in an AI use case. And so I think AI is driving the use case. I think there was use cases for this before. They just didn't have maybe a solution that would work as well. But yeah, maybe Kira designed this. Who knows?
I mean, as long as people don't try to run SQL on S3, because that was, I think it was like a year into my cloud, and a customer I was talking to was like, we're getting really bad performance and on our database. And I looked at it, I was like, oh, you're using S3FS running SQL on S3. And my brain just exploded.
Yeah. I mean, I would tell you that trying to run my SQL on EFS is not a great experience either.
No, it's not. It's a lot of IO.
There's really not a great option other than local disk on Amazon for running databases in general. So yeah, S3FS though, that's a real bad play.
That was a very quick migration for them.
Yeah. I mean, I was using EFS a bit for the CloudPow website, and then I was tired of how much it was costing, so I moved away from it. And our website doesn't need to be up all the time, so if it goes down for a couple of hours, it's on the end of the world, because we have CastOS, who basically hosts the podcast files for us if the website's down. And that's where all the RSS feeds pull from anyways. So really, the website's there for people to go check out, and then we publish there, but it gets synced to CastOS. So it's not critical in our infrastructure. So I was like, there's no reason to pay for EFS to have multiple ECS nodes talking to the EFS thing. But this is an interesting use case for some of the WordPress stuff I do, where potentially I could get away from using one of the S3 offload plugins that I use and use this instead. And so I'm going to check it out a little bit. I might use this for some of our WordPress sites, but not the database. The database will stay on local disk, because every time I have monkeyed with that, that's when performance goes real bad for the website.
I kind of wonder if we should look at a static site instead. I mean, mostly static site, when maybe with some supplemental stuff,
it's on my list of feedback. many AI projects to do.
Yeah,
because we could definitely move to a static site, but there's advantages to what we're doing with CastOS and WordPress that how much do I really want to spend on it? It always comes down to that question.
The podcast plugins for WordPress are they do a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah, when I first was creating it, I was looking at Jekyll a little bit, and there was some podcast plugins, but they were not great support on them, and they weren't really what I was looking for. And to do a CI/CD pull to do a simple podcast post is a bit clunky, but there are advantages of being able to take potentially our show notes from Heather and being able to automatically upload them to and trick off the trigger of the whole podcast production. There's things that would make it worthwhile, but also I could use WordPress CLI. So yeah, it's one of these, you get to that point of I can just use the WordPress CLI, but it's problem solved too. But Maybe someday. The redesign we did this year on the website dramatically simplified our template that we use. And it's pretty much a static website at this point. It does use WordPress to generate it, but then it's mostly static. And I could potentially offload a lot of that to to CloudFront and not even have it hit the website. All right, moving on to GCP. GK Inference Gateway now supports both real-time and async inference workloads on the same shared GPU-TPU accelerator pool, eliminating the need to maintain separate clusters for each traffic type. This addresses a common infrastructure inefficiency where real-time clusters sit idle during off-peak hours while async jobs run on underutilized secondary hardware. The async component works by integrating a batch processing agent with Cloud PubSub, where latency tolerant requests are pulled from a queue and routed to the inference gateway as lower priority shreddable traffic that fills unused compute cycles between real-time spikes. Testing shows that without the async processor agent, unmanaged multiplexing of low-priority requests causes 99% message drop, while using the agent resulted in 100% of latency-tolerant requests being served during available capacity windows, demonstrating the efficiency of priority enforcement mechanism doing meaningful work. This is all open source to you in LLMD-async project, meaning teams can use it in multiple cloud environments rather than just being blocked or locked into GKE. So this is a problem you're having on AWS or Azure. You can take a look at this code.
That's neat. Yeah, that's really cool, especially works in the interest of the cloud vendors now who can maximize their utilization of the GPUs. There's still a lot of CPU sitting there idle, though.
A lot of CPU idle.
60 to 70% CPU idle while those GPUs are full on, but yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of opportunity to take advantage of the CPU that's there. Google is releasing two new tools to address a core limitation of coding agents, outdated API knowledge due to training data cutoffs, and the Gemini API Docs MCP connects agents to live Gemini API documentation via the MCP protocol, while Gemini API developer skills adds best practice patterns and SDK guidances. Using both tools together shows measurable improvements in evals, achieving a 96.3 pass rate with 60% fewer tokens per correct answer compared to standard prompting. MCP server is accessible at Gemini API Docs MCP-dev, and works with any MCP-compatible coding agents, including Claude Code or Codex. The approach of pairing a live documentation server with a skills layer is a practical pattern other API providers could adopt, and I wish they would.
This definitely seems like a good middle ground to kind of gain that latest API stuff, because a lot of the stuff I work on, you know, Azure's Terraform provider is out of date in definitely areas, or it takes time for it to update, just like anything does. So if it's able to link over to the actual live docs, plus with, you know, how fast all these providers go, it's a game changer, at least on the, you know, where I use it on Terraform. So seeing it here just will make life better too.
Yeah, it's no coincidence this is from Google though, because their documentation sucks.
It's terrible. Yeah.
And if they're trying their best.
Read Microsoft's? Hold on, just gonna interrupt. Have you ever read Microsoft's documentation?
Yes.
I mean, I used to really like Amazon's documentation, but it's kind of gone to crap in the last few years too, so.
Yeah. It must be an embarrassment for them though to have, you know, a flagship AI model that can solve the deepest problems in physics and everything else, but it can't tell you how to spin up a VM with a Terraform provider because their documentation sucks so bad. It's quite
it's quite the conundrum, for sure.
It really is.
The problem with the old documentation is it just gets outdated so quickly. We do this, we've added this new feature. Okay, we got to update the documentation. And with how fast these cloud providers update stuff, the documentation to the API to everything just isn't updated. So I remember on AWS, Terraform, honestly, was where I got most features from when I was just looking at different things it can do because it was so well updated in that way, or looking at the Bodo API. And that was kind of the way back in the day, I kind of kept up to date on everything. Here, if the MCP is just reading the straight up Swagger docs on the API, it has the information right away.
It's true. Yeah, I have a project that I'm working on that they just released an MCP that connects directly to their documentation, which is like a bunch of skills around it that has made it so much better. Just like, oh, this is so much nicer than, you know, reminding it all the time, like, oh, that was a V1 thing. This is not the way it is in V2 anymore. Is really nice. And then like, oh, what do you mean? Like, my knowledge isn't from V1. I'm like, I know, here's the docs. And then you're using up context for things that aren't necessary. So I do appreciate that. And let's move on to Azure. Azure Network Watcher now offers a public preview feature called Rule Impact Analysis, which lets a network admin simulate the effect of security admin rules before actually applying them to their environment, reducing the risk of unintended connectivity disruptions. The feature is particularly useful for teams managing Azure Virtual Network Manager security configurations, as it helps identify rule conflicts and validate that connectivity requirements are met prior to deployment. I mean, 2026, and we still deal with rule conflicts and firewalls.
Hey, you can now stage them.
So, that's great. Yeah.
No, they're getting up there.
Takes me back to my checkpoint days where I was, it's like, oh no, the rule's a duplicate and causes all kinds of havoc.
I mean, it just shows how, I don't want to say immature, but how rudimentary a lot of the Azure firewall stuff is, you know, and all their network monitoring and everything is. They're still releasing a lot of the, you know, basic features to kind of get it up to speed so it can be more comparable to a real vendor versus where they're at today.
I mean, okay.
I have some pain. Let's just go with that.
Clearly, I just if you can't build it yourself, just buy it from somebody else. Like, that's what Google basically did with the next gen firewall. So, you know, partner with Palo Alto, build something that works in your cloud, and then this is a solved problem for you versus, you know, giving you bad products.
Do they have no kind of like dry run or test mode where you can create a rule that just creates log events instead of actually enforcing?
I know they do on the WAF. I believe they do on the firewall too. But now I'm questioning if it's on both WAFs, because the WAF for essentially the ALB, the load balancer for the app gateway, is actually different than the WAF for the front door, just to make life more confusing.
But is it in the Azure Application Gateway, the Azure Front Door, or the Azure CDN that you need the Azure Web Application Firewall? And where are those rules previewed in public? I mean, like, it's overly complex.
You can tell it's, no different than AWS. Two different teams that were told to build a WAF, and they did it, and there was no communication between the two to say, hey, maybe we should have a team that makes the general, hey, here's our standard rules that you recommend. Here's our OWASP top 10 rule protection. And then let that apply to both places.
Yeah. I mean, they just need to get a premium firewall product to then solve
they
all
have
the
that.
Problems. Oh, do they? Okay.
Yeah. Premium Azure there's three firewalls. I think there's basic, standard, and premium. Premium does the IDS, IPS. It has higher throughput, I believe, than the standard. I would have to double check all my notes.
Of course it does.
But the big one is the IPS and IDS versus just IDS. Because it's always good to be told that you're having, you know, issues without actually being able to block anything. That's why you need the premium one to actually do the blocking.
So IBetrix had a feature where you kind of had this cross-cloud, you know, visibility into rules end-to-end.
Yeah, that's more for like cross-cloud connectivity to private network side, not to public side.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume Aviatrix can do public as well. It's been a little bit since I've looked at it, but it was really designed more for like, hey, I want to connect Azure to AWS and then run workloads between those and to my data center. And so I need visibility end to end of that. But yeah, the front door side, I don't know. Maybe it improved it. Well, you know, we've always talked about premium and sort of had this kind of like, is it really giving you anything or any value? And so I found this great article on Reddit from a company called Go-EUC. And they did benchmark research comparing premium SSD and standard SSD disks for Azure VDI workloads in particular. And they found that premium SSD delivers up to 8 times higher IOPS and an 89% lower latency than standard SSD, with the performance gap widening as disk sizes increase. Standard SSD shows a fixed performance ceiling of roughly 850 to 980 IOPS, regardless of disk size, while premium SSD scales from 1800 IOPS at 128 gigabytes up to 8100 IOPS at 2048 gigabytes. Making disk sizing a meaningful architecture lever only for premium SSD. The cost comparison is less straightforward than it appears because standard SSD carries transaction fees that can push its total cost close to premium SSD pricing under heavy VDI workloads, making premium SSD a more predictable cost option despite its higher base price. The 2048 gigabyte premium SSD at $284.94 per month emerges as a recommended sweet spot, since moving to a 4096 gigabyte costs $545, only marginal performance gains, and a 2,500 seat scale, that size decision translates to over 7.8 million in annual cost differences. The research used synthetic disk speed tests rather than the real user load simulation, so results reflect maximum disk capabilities under controlled conditions and may differ from production environments. So, I mean, it's not Microsoft, it's not something Microsoft paid for, and it's something that was done independently. So, I approve.
You know, when you see 2,048 gigabytes for a month, that sounds like a lot, but 2 terabytes for a month for $284 is actually quite expensive.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, premium SSD is a lot. Yeah. I mean, VDI workloads are definitely their own, you know, nightmare to scale and beat and, you know, and work on. So it's definitely valuable, but, you know, it's just nice to see that there are actual values in these premium things you're getting, not just marketing, which is what we maybe have accused Microsoft of doing in the past, and now we have factual data that's not true.
But what about ultra premium though? That's what we should
play. Yeah, they didn't ask about ultra premium. Yeah. So fair enough.
They can't go EUC can't afford ultra premium.
Right.
I mean it the no-brainer for me in here at least is everything with Azure is as you go to a higher tier, it's more predictable pricing. It's kind of a lot of what they have. Same thing with blob storage, same thing with, you know, disks and everything. They, and even AWS and a lot of the other cloud providers. So like, as you go to the more premier, hot, whatever storage, the price per use goes down, but the base price goes up. And that's kind of the way all of Azure is structured in that way.
It's, and it's the worst part is that one little feature will push you into the higher tier, and now you pay a premium when you only need one feature. It makes sense when you have, like, you need two or three of the features. It's a problem when you only need one. That's
100%
where the sharp edges are.
Like front door, and the only way to get a connect to a storage account that is private is to have to be on premium versus standard.
Yep.
Just saying.
Just saying. In our emerging cloud section, DigitalOcean is launching a native cloud security posture management tool that continuously evaluates resources like your droplets and databases for misconfigurations without requiring agents or third-party tools, making it accessible to smaller teams without dedicated security staffs. The tool is built directly into DigitalOcean's dashboard and API, addressing a common pain point where security visibility requires separate tooling and context switching across platforms. I mean, I like this. Like, cool, you gave us a CSPM, but, like, you know, per cloud CSPM means that you're trying to manage us across multiple cloud providers. I mean, that DigitalOcean for most companies is a development environment versus a production environment, although some use it for production. I want to dismiss that capability. But centralized CSPM adds a lot of value in my mind. So I appreciate it. If this is all you're using is DigitalOcean, then, you know, you're getting value out of that. But, you know, nice to see it. Not something I'm super jazzed about.
You got to pay for it?
It's definitely a nice feature to kind of give the general developer or, you know, security person that might not know the intricacies of DigitalOcean. Hey, here's a red flag. Go look at this. Hey, your database is public facing. That's bad. But if you are managing a more enterprise environment, yeah, a centralized CSPM is definitely the way to go.
So Jonathan, to your question about price, it is a freemium model. It gives you free baseline scans for all people. Premium tier unlocks workload rules, advanced prioritization, API access, and automations to fix things that CSPM discussed, which I think is a good point to have a paywall.
Yeah, that's fair. At least they're giving everything to, the important bits to everybody. I suppose there's no reason you can't hook in some kind of CSPM into Terraform if that's what you're deploying with. So it's nice that they've got that they're covering the base is what they're doing. It's nice.
Well, gentlemen, we've reached the end of another fantastic week here on the cloud.
Yeah, 350 episodes down. It's crazy.
I know, it's crazy. That's again why I was mentioning, like, go leave a review, go leave a comment, message us on Twitter or Blue Sky or Mastodon, or, you know, join our Slack team and, you know, give us a hello and let us know what you're doing on the cloud and what you like and what you don't like as well, because we always like to improve. But 350 episodes. It's continuing to count down the days of my life. This is my birthday now too. All right. See you guys next week.
See you later.
Bye.
And that's all for this week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Archera. Be sure to click the link in our show notes to learn more about their services. While you're at it, head over to our website at thecloudpod.net, where you can subscribe to our newsletter, join our Slack community, send us your feedback, and ask any questions you might have. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Matt, you brought us an after show today. How Microsoft vaporized $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. I will tell you that I did not read this. So I'm going to turn it over to you to summarize it as summarizer in training.
Ooh, I was definitely not prepared for that. You should have.
I mean, I could
give you a heads up on that one.
I mean, I can read the basics of what you put here. The author, a senior Microsoft engineer who rejoined Azure Core in May 2023, discovered on his first day that a 122-person org was seriously planning to port large portions of Windows to a tiny, low-powered ARM chip on the Azure Boost Accelerator card, a plan he immediately recognized as physically impossible given the hardware constraints. Now, as an executive, I know that I don't want to be told things are impossible, so I'm sure this is going to go well. Nobody at Microsoft could explain why up to 173 agents were needed to manage each Azure node, what they all did, or how they interacted. Sprawl that created enormous fragility in the system, orchestrating VMs for OpenAI, government clouds, and other mission-critical workloads. After the elimination of dedicated testers in 2014 and a talent exodus of original Azure architects, much of the org was staffed by junior engineers with 1 to 2 years of experience, led by managers without deep system backgrounds and creating a persistent gap in senior technical leadership. The node management stack suffered millions of unattributed crashes per month, memory leaks, resource leaks, and zombie VMs, with each monthly release introducing more bugs that it fixed and most rollouts ending in panicked rollbacks. A publicly exposed web server, Wire Server, running on the secure host OS held unencrypted tenant data for multiple customers in shared memory caches, a serious security liability in a hostile multi-tenancy environment, while crashing 300 to 500,000 times per month. Oh, not just a few times. Despite public claims at Ignite conferences from 2023 to 2025 that the key components have been offloaded to Azure Boost and rewritten in Rust, the author states that as of late 2024, zero of 64 identified work items have been completed, and work hadn't started on roughly 60 of them. Digital escort sessions, where $18 an hour employees executed commands on production nodes under direction of overseas support staff, including from China, became routine, with nearly 200 just-in-time access requests per day observed over a two-month period, directly contradicting the original no-human-touch design vision. The author has proposed an incremental componentization strategy to modernize the node stack from first principles, including a cross-platform component model, a new message bus, and a security-hardened cache. The lower-level management responded with defensiveness, and the org eventually terminated his employment. Dun, dun, dun. Consequences materialized over time, with OpenAI signing an $11.9 billion CoreWeave in March 2025 and later a $300 billion deal with Oracle, apparently being alleged that it's tied to this poor infrastructure management.
So kind of the way I read the story was this senior developer kind of came back after years away from Microsoft and just saw what we call a slight disaster based on kind of the story that he proposed out there, where essentially back in the, when Azure was created, it was done very quickly and wasn't set up at all to scale, definitely not to the levels that it's at today. And there's been a ton of manual intervention, including essentially just-in-time requests that were just auto-approved, basically. And the whole hands-off, hey, everything's auto-built and it's going to be hands-off and automatically fix itself and everything just wasn't there. The tech debt is so large, basically, from what he's saying, that it's almost insurmountable. And they've essentially outsourced all the issues to, I mean, just call it, you know, help desk personnel that just go in and manually touch things all the time to fix it. And what made everything much worse was the signed deal with Azure, with OpenAI back in the day when it was first announced, because they needed so much capacity. And they, when Microsoft's first right to refuse, they obviously didn't want to refuse such a massive customer, that just made every other project drop off even more. And I don't know how accurate it is, but it's an interesting glimpse behind the scenes of these cloud providers, that how often do you really get to see how the cloud providers operate? And this is kind of saying, yeah, they're Microsoft's a little bit of a disaster.
It doesn't surprise me. I've spoken to several people who work for Oracle, or who did work for Oracle in the past, and there's an awful lot of manual tweaking goes on there as well. The guy I talked to was on the load balancer team, and you know, he told me about people literally logging in and tweaking settings and doing, you know, live changes on customer production load balancers because they were so buggy. Yeah. Also work with people who you know, staff a 200 person NOC and pay them to log into every Windows machine and reboot them once a week. So I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised either. The part that was interesting to me was, he talks about it more in the article, but essentially there was a big shift at one point and they got rid of their entire dedicated QA team, and it just caused code quality to go down, and they hired a lot of junior developers. And with such a complex environment, like any of these hyperscalers, you at least need some visionaries and some people that can help, you know, make sure that everything is going in the right direction. And it sounds like the talent drain that occurred, you know, in 2024 to 2020 just kind of destroyed Azure. And while they're able to keep growing and everything, their tech debt is just slowly killing them on the back end. And at one point, they're going to hit a breaking point.
I wonder what the real story is, but the fact that the guy was let go again. You know, you think if he was bringing these issues to light in a sensible way, that he would not get that kind of treatment. But
I mean, you just know he's you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
So no, he's not me. There's somebody else I have in mind, but it's not me.
You're just like, I mean, if he's more diplomatic, unlike myself, who's not diplomatic at these type of things, unsubscribe from all.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely, it feels a little bit like, you know, definitely sour grapes that he got terminated or whatever. But, I also, you know, question some of the Azure stuff because you see it on the outside. Like, some of this is very clearly, you can see outages. You can see some of these problems. So I don't dismiss him completely out of hand, but I definitely wonder how much is sour grapes versus real. But it is interesting, you know, the idea of being able to move portions of Windows to low-powered ARM chips. Yeah, that's never going to work. I mean, you can't move containers on Windows to Linux, for God's sakes, because it doesn't work. So, I mean, and Microsoft's already shown multiple times that ARM transformation is a problem for them. The first version of Windows they ported to ARM was terrible. and they canceled an entire product line because of it. They've now done it again with Windows 11, and it's much better, but it's still nowhere near what they had promised it would be. So,
I mean, the other interesting part to me was the 173 agents that run on Azure Node to keep it up and running, and no one able to define what those were and why they're there, which on one level doesn't surprise me, but 173 feels like a lot. Feels like also a lot of overhead.
I mean, 170 of them are definitely security agents.
God damn it, Ryan. So, I
don't know. That's where all agents come from, is security, it feels like, because, you know, unified agents aren't a thing. But yeah.
I mean, over time, it'd be interesting to see, you know, what the sour grapes of someone that leaves AWS and GCP are. And,
oh, yeah. You find them out there as well. You know,
yeah.
They don't always get a multi part, you know, Substack thread about it, but you know, definitely interesting and worth. I only read the first one, which is why I didn't have all the context of the part two, three, and four.
I think it goes up to six or seven. It kept going, and it's a little long-winded, but it's an interesting read. You know, it's kind of like reading the RCAs for me. It's what's going on behind the scenes that you don't really know about, but it's kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel about the Delve stuff is going at this standpoint. Like, it just keeps piling on at this point. And it's interesting, but I'm like, okay, we know that these things happened. And yeah, but you've already done the damage you wanted to do. So we'll see when they come back next week if it's any better. But Substacks are always kind of fun to read because they are a little bit of windiness. But all right, gentlemen, we'll see you next week. I'm going to have a birthday dinner.
Yep. See you later.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Bye.